Well, hey there, Sugar. This here is Rogue, and you are listening to Comics in Motion.
Welcome to Examining X-Men 97. I am your co-host, the ever-astonishing, ever-uncanny Spider Dan. And I'm back from the depths of the Shi'ar Galaxy. I have returned. However, I am sans my co-host this week. Max Byrne is having a little rest himself, so he's going to be back next week. But I have a new co-host, again for a second time, as Bastion got into my systems and corrupted me and my recording. So we're doing it again. And Sarah Coyne has magnanimously returned once again to do this later than planned. It was supposed to come out on Friday, but we're here again to talk all things X-Men. But Sarah, welcome to the show. Thank you again for joining me. I really appreciate you coming back after the technical issues we had last time. What a wonderful episode it was that people will never hear.
I know, exactly. Yeah, the episode's so good that so nice we made it twice.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about a sense of deja vu, no doubt. But as we did last week, again, this mysterious podcast that will never be heard. And you said all those offensive things, of course. No, you didn't.
Release the cancel cut.
No, nothing cancelable on that at all. I will happily send people if they want to listen to it. But we're going to talk about it all again here. But I wanted to ask, we've been talking about this for weeks now, how much we've been enjoying it and how much you've been getting out of it. And you've been listening to the podcast as well, catching up on with all of our thoughts, Max and Dave, who've been doing an excellent job while I've been away. But I wanted to ask you, how did you find X-Men? What's your relationship with them? Was it the comics that got you? Was it the animated series? Was it the movies? You know, how do you feel about what they represent, the allegories and the metaphors? And how you found the show, how you found the original show, did you watch the original show, and then we'll get on to this episode.
Yeah, of course. So I was born in the 90s, and for me, my kind of main exposure to the X-Men, it's got to be done. So for me, it was the animated series and the film, which I kind of, if I recall correctly, I kind of discovered them around the same time. I think I started watching the cartoon and then it was like, oh no, there's a film coming out. So it all just kind of snowballed from there, depending on your outlook of it. And like, I was always into my superheroes and stuff like Batman, Superman. But I think X-Men always kind of held a bit more of a special place in my heart, just because I loved the fact that it's about family at the end of the day. And you've just got such a great range of characters, you know, like Batman, Spider-Man, fantastic characters and characters within those universes, but the X-Men have such a huge cast and array of characters, especially female characters as well. Like, you know, not only are there so many to choose from, they're all so distinct from one another. And I think the social justice element of it and the kind of civil rights allegory, I think, always really spoke to me as well. Because even the villains, quote unquote, in it tend to have very good points and have good talking points. So I think it was kind of useful to sort of watch something like that when you were younger and sort of realize like, oh, you know, these things aren't always black and white, even if there is in some ways a definitive right thing to do. You know, there's context and there's things to be considered in these arguments. So yeah, I just always really loved it.
Yeah, same here. I kind of, this was, I said, I think I said this in the first episode we did, the previously on X-Men podcast, but I said it was kind of like my kind of, I don't know, like my moral base, like how I see and view the world and people and everything. And yeah, it's a wonderful, I think this show, and again, I think I said this before, but this show, I think, is more relevant now than it's ever been, and probably more important that we need a show like this.
Yeah, 100%. And I kind of feel like, I remember thinking from the first two episodes, it was like, okay, like you said, we had a kind of moral baseline watching it when we were kids, like in the 90s. And the older we've gotten as an audience and the worse the world's got, it does really feel like this show has aged with us and matured with us. And so now it can actually really get into the weeds of some of these issues. So yeah, I just think that's what makes it so brilliant.
Yeah. And my friends, like our friend Nathan's been saying, oh, well, it's a kid's show. And I was like, I don't think it is. I really don't think this is. Like most kids are interested in playing Fortnite. They're not going to be interested in a 30-year-old show that they never watched. You know, it's not for them. It's for us. It's for that kind of the 90s bitches out there. You know, it's for us, and again, it has grown with us, and it's matured, and even like Eric and Julia Leewald, who were the showrunners of the original show, you know, they were like saying, you know, have people learned nothing? Like we were talking about this 30 years ago, and people still haven't really, they still have not learned this lesson or got what this is about, and so was the kind of. As the show was being announced and the characters and the ideas and what was being represented, people are going, X-Men's gone woke. It's all woke. And you're like, it always was.
Well, the hilarious thing about that is I think it's done the classic thing where before it came out, it was like, oh, they've gone woke, they've gone broke. And now that it's successful, it's like, yeah. Right. Okay. Well, we can't say that it's got, so it's quieted down. And I've even seen some people kind of try to retroactively say, but it wasn't technically woke because of XYZ, like these really arbitrary things. Like, what are you talking about? Just this idea that those themes have always been there. And if we could tell that as, you know, kids in the 90s, and you can't tell that now as presumably an adult, then sort your life out, don't you?
100%. Sort your fucking life out, pal. If you're not on board with X-Men, get off, because this is what it's always been about and always will it be about, marginalized people and prejudice. If you're not on board with that sentiment, just get fucked.
It's not for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You put it a lot more diplomatically than I would, but there you are. But yeah, like how have you found the show? I've got a sense that you like it as we have been messaging. I think I've been very subtle about it.
Very not forthcoming about my feelings on it. I genuinely think it's fantastic. I was really excited for it coming out, and if it had just been the same kind of level as the animated series, I think I'd have been really happy. But to see that they have just taken it to this other level, you know, we're getting so much interesting character development, and I think what I love about it as well is it's really made me look at a lot of characters with a second pair of eyes and really go, oh, well, maybe I was definitely wrong about certain characters who we'll get to. But it's also just given us more to love about the characters that we loved already and that were established. So it just feels like they really understand what makes X-Men work and what makes these characters work and the relationships. And it's just been crafted with so much love.
Yeah, I think, again, we've talked about it throughout the podcast, but the writing is absolutely superb. Beau DeMaio's writing, his handle on the everything about it, the lore, the characters, the action, the allegories, everything that he's done within this show is absolutely spot on. There's some real nice Easter eggs if you're looking for them, but I think you said again you don't like to do a lot of homework, and again I think you said you weren't a huge, you didn't really read the comics, it was more the show, wasn't it, and the films that you kind of gravitated towards, and that's fine as well. Like I don't go you're not a real X-Men fan if you didn't read 191 of Uncanny X-Men. How dare you say you're an X-Men fan? Absolutely not. Come on board, you know, everyone's welcome. You know, if you enjoy it, you enjoy it. Whatever you enjoy, you know, it doesn't even have to be this particular X-Men show. If you like Evolution or if you like Wolverine and the X-Men, fair play. If you like the video games, if you like all that, come on board.
I mean, I am an Evolution fan, just for the record as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I liked it. It wasn't kind of like, I get why people like it. It was very much the Buffy version of X-Men, I think, which
yes
which Buffy Summers is unsurprisingly named after the Summers boys and family, the Summers family. And Joss Whedon did go on and write Astonishing X-Men as well. So it's all connected. It's all linked together. And Disney now own Buffy. So they wanted to do a crossover. They could. It was definitely a show I enjoyed and went back to and rediscovered. But it wasn't, again, I think I was being a bit of a purist back then, sort of like, it's not my X-Men, yeah, kind of thing. But I did go back and kind of reevaluate my thoughts on it. So, yeah. But, yeah, really good show, really interesting take. Like, they actually went to high school, because I think I had an issue with that, because I was like, but actually, that was probably one of the more interesting aspects of it. Anyway, I think we should talk about the episode itself. So why don't you give us a brief synopsis? So there's kind of three different parts all going on at once. So why don't you give us the lowdown?
Cool. So yes, episode 8, Tolerance's Extinction, part 1. So yep. So in this episode, we are seeing the aftermath of what's gone down in Madripoor, where Trask was revealed to be a Prime Sentinel. He attacked Rogue. Rogue is still alive, but she's incapacitated in a coma, which I actually thought was about, I can't remember if I mentioned this in the last one, but I thought that was a really nice mirror to Miss Marvel.
Yes.
And that kind of aspect in the original series. So Rogue's there. Everybody's looking after her, obviously. Nightcrawler, Jean, everybody kind of rallying around her. While at the same time, Beast is working out with Cable kind of what these Prime Sentinels are. And they bring up the idea that the Prime Sentinels are actually, like, in his future, it's not the typical dystopia that we're used to seeing from the time travel shenanigans in this show. It's a utopia. But the flip side of this part of Charles's dream of collaboration and kind of cooperation being achieved is that it's done on the backs of mutant labor. So basically the mutants are accepted, but only as an underclass. So that's also an interesting thing that we'll talk about. And and then we also see a bit of Bastion and part of his plan and how he's been working with Val Kooper, and they've got Magneto in a very uncompromising position.
Mag Speedo, as he's been called online, he's been named online. Very. I think the writer was having a lot of fun there at that point. Definitely.
Yeah, he understands the assignment in the X-Men is for the gays.
Absolutely. Yeah, you don't get those kind of, you know, there's a reason he's in that kind of cross, you know, bloody, I don't know what you call it. Is it like a brace or a back brace or whatever the name for it is, I'm not sure.
Crucifix. It does have a name, but it's completely escaping me now.
Message in, the LGBTQ plus or bondage community. Tell us what it is, because I don't know the name. Kind of a rack, I guess, or like
maybe
a back rack. I don't know, but maybe I'll Google it while we're talking.
Yeah, I feel like all the detractors who were like, "No, Rogue and Magneto, it's so gross," probably saw that and went, "Okay, I get it."
Yeah. I get it. I can see it. There's that, and we've got Sunspot and Jubilee still dealing with the kind of the ramifications of him coming out as a mutant to his mother and her feelings on the topic as well. We have the Summers family reunited, which is a really interesting. They're playing around with a lot of stuff here. And then we also kind of have the what's going on with the mansion as well, I think. We've got kind of, it's more 4 really, isn't it? You've got the Bastion stuff, more so 3, but I guess I focused on the X-Men specifically. But yeah, where would you like to start?
Where to start? I think that's the thing. There's so much. Where to start? Who knows? What about we start with the Summers family? Because I think that's that's quite a good through line for all of them. It obviously starts off and, Scott has realized that Cable is his son after all this time. And we see that there's obviously some familial conflict there. Scott is obviously feeling like a terrible father. He gave his son away and he's grown up to be a kind of vengeful Terminator cyborg, and obviously things with him and Jean are better, but I think there's still that disconnect there. And then Jean's obviously worried about the fact that she's not technically Cable's mother, but she still feels like it, which gives Kurt a great excuse to come in and have this really beautifully written segment about, you know, blood isn't everything, you know, you feel like his mother, you are his mother. And, you know, something that really kind of gets to the crux of, like I said, X-Men is about family, it's about found family. So yeah, all that's great.
Yeah, I really, again, I'm really happy we've got Kurt. I know you're a big Gambit fan, and unfortunately he's no longer with us. But I think out of the lineup that they had, if anybody had to go, it was probably Gambit. I know there's probably some people out there who wanted Jubilee to go, but I think, no, I think she needs to be there. And the fact that, you know, obviously nobody can replace Gambit. I'm not a big fan of Gambit, but even the way he went out in this show, I was kind of like, that's a cool character.
Yeah, you couldn't
that's
have
the
really
best
asked
way.
For a better exit for the character. Like, he really got to show off his powers, and he had this like really emotional arc with Rogue in it. So yeah, as someone who is a big Gambit fan, anyway, I just thought that was kind of the perfect send-off from a boy. But don't get me wrong, I do absolutely adore Nightcrawler as well.
Agree.
Like, if I had to critique the animated series, I think they criminally underused Kurt in that series. But the fact that they've got him back as a more fleshed-out character, and it's the original voice actor as well. And he's nailing it.
Yeah, he is. Absolutely. I agree. And they're kind of balancing the character a bit more. It's a bit more like the comics. He's playful and fun and joyful, yet still has that kind of Catholic, emotional, kind of religious side to him. But it's a nice balancing and kind of repositioning. You know, again, I'm sure we'll have more Catholic guilt and Catholic shame. I'm sure we'll get those later on. But yeah, I thought the way they're handling him and his friendship with Wolverine is just kind of growing, and they have a wonderful kind of team up moment, which I'm sure everyone is. I loved. But yeah, I think. That whole found family thing. I mean, they didn't necessarily need to be as explicit as they were, but it was a nice interaction. And I think it was something that Jean needed, given where they are, because they are this kind of fractured family. Like, and Scott was like, you know, I don't want to abandon my son. And he now has pretty much the same relationship he had with his father. What I noticed on this rewatch as well is that when they go to visit Bastion's mother, she's like, oh, you need to cherish every moment with your child because they grow up so quick, and you've got this elderly Cable next to his mum and dad.
Yeah, I thought that as well. Like, you know, Scott Summers, whose lats have abs, Cable just towers over it. And so, yeah, the shot of them, they grow up so fast with just this absolute unit of a man. I thought that was pretty funny. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the last time Scott saw him, you know, canonically probably weeks or months ago, he was a literal newborn, and now he's fully grown Cable. So yeah, I hadn't really clocked that idea of that. Probably is what it feels like for some parents.
Yeah, it's got all the gray hairs and everything. But yeah, it's a very unusual thing. X-Men's interesting because it does feature like a lot of time travel characters. We see Rachel Summers in this, who in the comics, she sends Ascani to collect Cable and bring him to the future. It's not Bishop. And she's the head of this kind of matriarchal kind of religious cult kind of thing. And she's looking after him and cares for him and kind of brings him up a little bit. So it's interesting that she was featured in the future along with Polaris and all the other things going on. But I think it says something about the show and what the X-Men represent, is that there's all these, because they are fighting for the future, and there's all these characters from the future going, yeah, it didn't quite work out, the dream didn't quite happen, so we've got to do something, we've got to come back, we've got to try and do it again. And you get characters like Bishop or X-Man, who is a version of Cable, or Cable coming back, or Rachel Summers, you name it. But it's interesting that it's the future, but not quite the future, but that they've got to fight for the present and hopefully get a better future. So I think that's probably why time travel is so recurring within the kind of X-Men franchise, in the shows, in the films, in the cartoons. We see it more and more and more. But I think it works. Speaking of time travel, I was talking to Max about it in a previous episode, that we might, because we have Bishop and we have Cable, I was worried that they were going to undo Genosha and bring Gambit back and all the people that had died. But they talk about Kamar-Taj, who in the MCU is where Stephen Strange goes. And again, he's all about kind of time travel, and his film's all about time travel. And then we learn as well in the What If show, another animated Marvel property, which I think some of the creators on this worked on that as well. He's trying to save his girlfriend, and he realizes there's fixed points in time or non-alterable points in time, kind of like Doctor Who and various other kind of franchises. They go, no, you can't. This has to happen. There's no way we can undo this. And that's what Wolverine asks. If you're Mr. Time Travel, you're Mr. Terminator. Why don't you go back and stop? And he's like, I tried. And the fact that he's kept trying as well. He's like, how many times have you tried? So much that I'd give up. And how many times has he seen his mum die in front of him? You know, it's a real tragic, you know, hard-hitting thing. But I'm really glad that, again, it will not take away from that episode, because we still have those deaths. It still occurred. It's important. And again, what Beau DeMaio is exploring with a lot of these kind of tragic events like the Pulse nightclub and 9/11, I think it would be kind of sacrilegious to just snap your fingers and that's not happened anymore. So I'm really glad that they stuck with that. How do you feel about them going, Genosha has to happen?
Yeah, I completely agree. Like you said, obviously it's tragic. But I think we had this in Endgame, and you know, Endgame's great, and you know, don't want to take that away from it. But and it is the one thing I don't really like about time travel when it's used in, you know, films, TV, anything like that anyway, because I feel like it's too easy to write yourself into corners where you're like, oh, we can just undo it. So it cheapens everything and things don't have that same weight. So I think, I mean, you know what it's like. Superheroes never stay dead for long. So I'm sure that we will see some, if not all these characters, resurrected or reused in some aspect. But yeah, I think for something that impactful to stay impactful, it needs to stay the way it is. And I think that's what's made it so powerful, is I think this series hasn't been afraid to like have us watch the characters sit in this tragedy and really sit in that loss and that grief. And I think that's what's made it so powerful. So to just, like you said, snap your fingers, oh, Gambit back. Yeah. You cheapen it a bit. So yeah, I really appreciate the fact that they are taking a stand with it and going like, no, it's a fixed point. Mm. That's it.
Mm. No, I agree. And you were saying about the utopia, and Cable describes it as Charles's dream. And I think Bastion as a character is quite charismatic. But what he's doing is very evil. But the kind of motivation behind it, you can kind of understand. And much like kind of Magneto, I think they're trying to kind of place him in a kind of a similar way, because it's revealed that he's not a robot himself, technically, or, you know, a machine. He's a kind of a bonding of the Nimrod technology from the future, from the days of futures past, Master Mold and all this other stuff. But he is human as well. So he's kind of and they describe it as kind of an apex species, the new kind of evolution that is going, and the Beast describes is going to breed as well. It's going to create, you know, this is the next step in human evolution, when actually, you know, mutants were supposed to be that. And then they talk about being left behind by the future. What do you think to Bastion and his kind of, just the way he's being depicted?
I really like his depiction. I think Theo James is doing a really fantastic job with the voice acting. Yeah. Like, I think it was you that said, like, unrecognizable. Like, if anything, I thought, I can't remember who I thought it was, but
I thought it was Neil McDonough, who was...
Yes, that was it. Yeah. Yes, he sounds like him. And I think his design kind of looks like he's based on him a little bit. So yeah. maybe that's what they were going for.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite kind of voice actors as well. He was Bruce Banner in the 90s Incredible Hulk. Maybe they'll bring that back as well. So maybe we'll hear him as Bruce Banner again. But yeah, no, that's who I thought it was. And then when I was like, wait, the guy from The Inbetweeners, he was in that. I was like, okay, sure. But yeah, absolutely.
I'm talking about the range. I really like his depiction. And like, as you said, I think he is coming across as charismatic, charming. And that classic thing of you hear him argue his case, and the way that he argues it, you understand the logic behind it, and you can see why these people that he's talking about, who he's recruited, quote unquote, to become prime sensors, you can see why they would be swayed by that argument, because it is playing off this fear that we see that the humans in the series have about, well, what about us? You know, are we going to be made obsolete? How are we going to work when we can't compete with people that are, you know, superhuman? And also just it's the kind of cold sort of calculating, very utilitarian way of looking at it, of just like, oh, well, this is the way that, you know, it kind of hurts in the short term, but it's better for everybody. But also, I think what really chilled me was that line about, you know, he had to make Genosha happen because, you know, people were becoming too sympathetic for mutants. So to kind of stop that is you have to overload people with tragedy, because then the only answer is apathy. And it was just, oof. You know, I think, unfortunately, like you said, the show gets more and more relevant. And I think it's lines like that that I just think so succinctly capture what it is kind of like to live in the world, particularly in the Western world, where we're thankfully a lot of the time quite far removed from these tragedies. And for most people, even if they are well-meaning, there's just so much you get bombarded with constantly that most people do just look away. So the fact that the series just kind of captured that for me, really, like, it like I said, it's matured with us. It's a level beyond, you know, sometimes people are bad for good reasons and blah, blah.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I think it's kind of, I think if you did paint all of the characters, like Val Cooper, you could paint as, you know, this right-wing kind of politician that is, you know, and she kind of has been, but there's a bit more, like you said, there's a bit more nuance to it. It's not just, and I think if it was just that, if it was all the people who are maybe, you know, the audience that are right-wing leaning, you know, if they all felt like maybe they were, all the villains were right-wing or extreme right-wing, that they might feel a little, you know, put out, or they might be like, oh, well, you're preaching to me or something. But it is doing it in a kind of a very intellectual level. And I think you mentioned on the previous podcast about the people that he's recruiting and the chat rooms. And again, that's a very real life thing. There's disenfranchised people that feel left out or hard done by, and they're looking for something, and they feel like they can't speak their mind without being, you know, and again, a lot of these people are really horrible and really disturbing, and they've got a whole host of kind of mental health problems, but Bastion's manipulating that, like, you know, like the media, like politicians, they're using that to he's using that to his advantage. These vulnerable people, you know, be right wing leaning or not, he's absolutely on top of them and using them. And Val Cooper's, you know, like, you're weaponizing civilians.
Yeah, another great line, because I thought that was just, obviously this is the most extreme version of that sentiment, yeah, but absolutely. In a way, like you said, that is what goes on in our world today, is, you know, people, like you said, they feel disenfranchised, they feel forgotten about and kind of listless, they need a purpose. And that's very easy for people who want to take advantage of that, who don't want to get their own hands dirty, that they can kind of whip up anger and resentment in these people who then go out and, you know, do horrible things and say horrible things. So, you know, the people who've whipped it up can rest easy at night, but, you know, the people who have done these things may have just been misguided or just needed help and support, but instead they just get used as tools in this kind of horrible culture war, or whatever you want to call it. Also, there was a line as well that I had interesting feelings about, where he mentioned something about, you know, he talks about, we've you know, engineered them to be prime sentinels, so they could be triggered at any time. And he mentioned something about, you know, a mutant flirts with them in a bar. And I was like, oh, that's a loaded line, because it made me think of like gay and trans panic, yeah, again, yeah, quote, yeah, unquote. Which, okay, it was a bit of a throwaway line, granted, but to kind of bring that up as something that happens, and we do see that people are victims of that, of people that just, again, because they've been whipped up by these sentiments, that's how they enact it, with violence against people who they should really have more in common with. But so yeah, I thought that was a really interesting line to just kind of add in there for people that would catch it.
Yeah, it's real intelligent storytelling. And I think I think that's one of the benefits of the show. We have our, you know, we have our fun, we have our action sequences, we have the mutant powers, but deep down, this is the discussion. This is it. This is what it's about, you know. And again, if you want to enjoy it as a show, and you know, it's, you know, the flights of fancy and stuff, that's fine. But really, this is the nitty gritty discussion. And it's asking some hard questions. It's asking you to ask yourself these hard questions. And I think that is very, very important and kind of, again, just a wonderful part of the show, you know. And one of the things I, you know, Disney could have been really like, this is too much. This is too risky. This is, you know, and I think that's why this is working, because it's so fucking bold. Of Disney, who are kind of always a bit like, oh, Beauty and the Beast is going to have a gay moment. Ooh, it's two men dancing. It's not that big a deal. But it got banned in all these countries because somebody made a point of it. But, you know, the fact that they've embraced this and gone, no, this is something we're going to put out and people are going to enjoy. And again, this is why the kind of, you know, the people going, oh, it's woke, have quietened down, because it's quality as well.
Yes, like, exactly.
It has the message, it has that, but it's quality. It's very, very good. And I think if it was very, very bad and had the message, then they'd have an argument for it. They go, oh, well, it was bad because it was woke. No, it's just bad. It's just bad and has a message, and you've noticed it because it's bad, and you're looking for things to destroy it and tear it apart with. But because it has been fucking excellent from the get-go, that's why all the arguments have now quietened down. But yeah, that's just me. But yes, we were talking about the summers, weren't we? And then we went on a tangent. I really like Jean's kind of over-mothering of Cable in this as well. Like, the, you know, put your seatbelt on and you're going to be in trouble. And he's like, you know, stop bumping me about. Stop telling me what
like
to do.
She's kind of given herself permission to be in mum mode, like she is going full Mama Bear. But it's great as well, because, yeah, it's nice to kind of see other sides of these characters, you know, particularly Cable. I think the series is quite happy to, because, like, again, from my kind of maybe surface level, arguably knowledge of kind of X-Men, all I'd really known of Cable was from the animated series and also from the last Deadpool film. So I kind of only really saw him as this sort of thing you said, like Terminator style, kind of like man on a mission. So the fact that the series isn't afraid to kind of play with that a little bit and actually have him be a bit like petulant teenager, like tell me what to do, is really sweet and really cool. And I think that's another reason I think the show works in general, is because, like you said, it's got these deep dark themes and these characters that go through hell, but there was also a lot of humor in there as well. Yes. You know, this episode has a lot of really funny lines just kind of peppered throughout. So yeah, and I think that kind of, it breaks the tension. It means that it's not all kind of meandering and horrible. You know, we still see that these are people with other sides and really funny sides. Like, we get some good zingers from Jubilee and Morph, and like I said, just that little moment with Cable of like, stop telling me what to do, that made me laugh.
and yeah, I like this dynamic. I really hope they play with that more in future, because I'm really on board for it, because it's playful, it's fun. Like you said, the humor is there, the characters are there, and yeah, and like, again, like, I think with Bishop and Cable, they can be quite similar sometimes. They're like two guys from the future. And again, they've been at odds in the comics and in the show as well. You know, they've both got big guns and, you know, they're all again, very man on a mission style. And I think because Cable came back, I think that's probably why we lost Bishop, because they kind of clash a little bit. I do hope we get a little bit of a backstory, because it implies that Bishop kind of sort of loses the baby in the time stream, the baby Nathan.
Sold him for drinking money.
Yeah, I was like, that's not a good look for you, Bishop, that you've lost. I don't know. I mean, we don't know how time travel
works.
You had
one job, Bishop.
Yeah, but one job. But again, we've been told in this episode that time does its own thing, so maybe time pulled, you know, Cable away from him, or, you know, whatever that. But again, I do want a bit of a backstory of how his time band works and what his kind of, he's like, I've seen all these different futures. So I would kind of like a solo Bishop episode, which I'm kind of hoping maybe we get some more of those in the following kind of series, because I know this is kind of the blueprint for this was not Zack Snyder. The blueprint was not Zack Snyder. It was the season one. So they kind of, it, you know, involves the Sentinels quite a lot, and it's getting all the kind of politics in there and the ideas and the prejudice. So I'm hoping maybe season two has a season two blueprint where it's kind of more one-off adventures with solo characters like Rogue's Tale or Externally Yours. I think we got two kind of solo Wolverine ones as well, I think, as well. I reckon you'll definitely get a solo Wolverine one next season because of all the people complaining they've not had enough Wolverine in this series.
As if we've not already been like overfed Wolverine, like a goose being fed for pate. And again, that's as someone that adores Wolverine. Like Wolverine was probably always my favorite character. And even I'm like, enough. There are other characters in the X-Men.
Yeah, please. He's not the sum total of the X-Men and wasn't there originally. He joined later. He was introduced in the Incredible Hulk. I don't think he was even a mutant in that. I think the original origin was he was going to be the High Evolutionary. We evolved him from a real Wolverine into a human as one of the new men. Some bizarre origins he may or may not have had at one point. He has a great moment in this when he's flying through the Sentinels and he's like slashing away. They gave him a real focus, not a lot of kind of character stuff, but enough where I was like, you know, him talking about, you know, Beast choice in women and stuff and and the emergence of these Sentinels. And I think, again, you mentioned it in the previous podcast, of the use of the word Neanderthal a lot in this.
It's a bit of a kind of running scene. They mention it three separate times. And yeah, I do think that's an interesting thing to bring up, because obviously Neanderthals, as someone who isn't a scientist, someone please write in and correct us if any of this is wrong. But yeah, so from my understanding, like Neanderthals were around at the same time as Homo sapiens, and there's kind of arguments as to what killed them, like what killed them off. You know, was it just they just didn't adapt to the environment? Were they killed off by humans? So, which obviously, yes, incredibly relevant to the topic of the series, because you know you've got this idea of there has to be a winning side rather than like working together. But yeah, well, like you said, back to the Wolverine stuff. Like, yeah, this was peak Wolverine behavior. I mean, like you said, I think the series so far, they've not utilized him as much as they normally would, but I think he has had some really great character moments. Like you said, you know, he drove Jean to the hospital. He's had his moments with Morph where they've had their friendship. There was that. I wonder if we'll see it again, reference to the fact that Jean kissed him and he actually turned her down. And I was like, that's character progression. I think Logan's already had some really good stuff in there, but it was incredibly cathartic seeing him like really set about these Sentinels and, like you said, like stabbing them and slashing them in the air, and then obviously Kurt gets involved, and just to see them team up was just
it was great. And they have such a great friendship in the comic, and they're drinking buddies. They're so like opposite yet so similar at the same time, which I love. And even in the show, you know, we had his episode Nightcrawler, and their friendship is quite, you know, there's a lot of kind of shared personal growth for both of them, I think. Just a wonderful, again, this like wonderful animation. It's just come on leaps and bounds from the first episode onwards. You know, just gorgeous bit of, you know, and the use of their powers, and just a wonderful kind of action set piece. All the stuff that happens at the mansion, I absolutely adored.
I mean, we had the sort of point of view shot of Logan as he goes through, like travels through space with Kurt while he teleports. That was fantastic. And yeah, just that kind of, you know, it's not really a long shot technically, but yeah, that animated shot where you could see them both like in the wide fighting and working together. And obviously you've got Kurt tri-wielding. I mean, as soon as those swords fell off the wall, it was like, yes, let's go. Then when they revealed that third one in his tail, they got me.
But, well, like in the comics, is like one of his heroes is Errol Flynn. probably shouldn't be anybody's hero in real life, I'll be honest, if you want to look into Errol Flynn and the kind of things he did. But he used to have an image inducer in the comics which could holographically give him a human look, and he would always choose kind of Errol Flynn. So it was kind of, it's a nice little character trait in it. And I think from then on, he's kind of always wielded swords on some level or another at some point. But yeah, I just adore the character and everything they're doing with him. But yeah, let's talk about Sunspot and Jubilee's shopping trip.
Yes, Jubilee, done with malls.
Absolutely.
Don't blame her.
Every time she goes to the mall, it's not good. It's really not good.
I mean, I've really enjoyed their storyline kind of through the series. Like, I know a lot of people don't like Jubilee. She probably wasn't always my favorite, because I think I used to kind of fall in with that very, like, no, I'm one of the boys, so I have to find the kind of only young girl character kind of annoying, and now I'm shut up. Like, no, yeah. But Jubilee's great. She's got a lot of personality, and I think she's been a really nice... Well, the fact that Sunspot has kind of taken on her role that she had in the animated series, so I think she's been a really good way to kind of bring him into the team, and especially with him obviously going through his family issues and the fact that he's not out to his family. So we obviously see that in this episode. His mother's, you know, kind of telling them how she's hosting a fundraiser for Genosha and, you know, those poor souls. And you kind of already understand that it kind of smacks of hypocrisy, because she isn't willing to openly accept her own son, who is also a mutant. Like, that was very kind of, you know, we've got to keep that under our hats. Jubilee is just like, stop this, let's go to the mall.
yeah. She's like, you've got a trust fund and you're spending it on me. And they kind of give her more of a modern outfit. I think she had that outfit when she was a vampire, but don't get me started on all that in the comics. I quite like this. She's like, well, I'm going to spend your money. It'll make me feel better. Kind of retail therapy kind of thing. But what I really like is that secretly Sunspot, like, he's shown in public using his powers now. Like, he's okay with it. He's done it. He's got through that kind of mental block where in Motendo he was just using a crowbar. Even in a alternate dimension where his mum probably would never see what he's doing, he's still, you know, not okay with showing those abilities. But we learn that, you know, Jubilee's influence, this positive influence it's had on him, he's been practicing, he can fly, he can, you know, project his powers, he's super strong. All the kind of abilities he had in the comic. And I love that moment where it's like, how can everyone fly but me? And she kind of tries to do, I think she tries to do something that Abyssa did in the...
I think she tries to kind of do an Iron Man and propel herself with her kind of fireworks, which, I mean, yeah, if you'd seen other people do a similar thing, like, you think, fuck it.
Yeah. But then she falls and then she's like, oh, even you can fly. And he's like, yep, sorry. You know. And then we get that moment, and I don't like this term, but people talk about like virtue signaling. And I feel like this is what his mum's doing is actually virtue signaling. I think a lot of people use it in a very negative way, that term, and I don't particularly care for it. But
I think it's that thing of, I think what they're talking about does exist, but not in the sense that they think it does. So if we use Mrs. DaCosta as an example. So, yeah, she is virtue signaling, because she's saying, all these poor souls, we have to raise money. But it's all kind of done in the service of, like, let's all get dressed up and have a gala and have a party, but we can kind of feel like we're doing something. So it's all very surface level. But behind the scenes, she isn't even willing to be proud of her own son, who is directly... So it's like when people say, like, oh, it's virtue signaling, it's like, somebody described it once, it's like they've correctly identified it as bullshit.
Yes.
But they, like, people that use it as a detraction are just like, oh, but, you know, you shouldn't, like, it's virtue signaling because those things are bad. It's like, no, it's bad because they're bullshitting about actually believe.
Exactly. They're presenting themselves as something they're not, basically.
Yeah.
And again, she's talking about, you know, she's talking about, oh, like, oh, well, you know, order this many drinks because sloppy signatures. She doesn't even care about a guest, really.
Mm.
And the real telling moment for me is he comes to, like, Roberto comes through the window, the Prime Sentinels are chasing him, and she's a bit in shock, but she doesn't even go, he goes immediately, Mom, and there's a real delay for her to even say his name, And then you get the side eye because she's looking at all the guests going, and they're all going, her son's a mutant. Oh my God. What is she doing? You know, and they're shown to be, you know, false people as well, because they're kind of being judgmental and they're, you know, they're presented with the facts of the world and the way mutants are being hunted and treated. And he's going, and he even says, like, these killer robots are trying to kill me. Like, that's the line. These killer robots are trying to kill me. And his mum goes, just go with them.
Yeah, all it takes is them going, no, we're not trying to kill you. We're trying to save you. Like, oh, well, that checks. Like,
and again, that's what I like, because it's, again, it's showing you how, because they're present. They're not robotic enough that they'll just go and do it, what they're programmed to do. They are a symbiosis of man and machine, because they know what the optics are on this. If they are shown to be killing a mutant in front of all these people, they're the bad guys. So they're smart enough, they've evolved, that they know how to play the kind of media game and the public relations game. They go, we'll stand down. No, we're here to help them. We're here to, you know, and they're like, oh, well, if they're here to help them, then I guess it's okay. Then they can go. And they're carried away with the collars on. But yeah, like, just, you know, awful human being.
Yeah, I mean, it was enough of a gut punch in the episode where he actually verbally came out to her, because, you know, they really didn't get us with the one safe thing. You know, she's like, oh, no, of course, we understand. It was your it was your secret to tell. We love you. But let's not tell anyone, shall we? You know, stop. So that was already like, oof. Like, because I would imagine that's probably quite a common thread for people that come out. I mean, I remember watching Ian McKellen do his kind of one-man show live, and he talks about the first time he came out to his aunt, I think it was. And like, God love her, she was like, oh, Ian, I thought you were going to tell me something terrible. But then almost straight away was, you're not going to tell so-and-so though, are you? And even he kind of pointed out that that's so often the issue, is that people don't mind themselves, but it's this concern with what everybody else thinks, even though, like, by and large, nobody really cares, and everybody's just kind of too busy living their own lives. And so everybody should feel comfortable to come out, and nobody should have to feel like they have to be forced to hide a part of themselves, or if they are even associated with people that are open, that it reflects badly on them.
It's a hypocrisy, isn't it? It's the it's the absolute hypocrisy of it. And again, I can understand where it's stemming, unfortunately, it's stemming from a place of love, because they want to protect the people in their lives. So Roberto's mom is trying to protect him from the outside world, because she doesn't know how they're going to react, or, you know, if he's going to be attacked in the street, or whatever could happen. So I get it and I understand it. But that again is the wonderful nuance in the show, that it's not just, oh, she's a racist. You know, there's layers to it.
Yeah, I think it would have been so easy for them to have had her just be like, what, you know, kind of like the what happens with Rogue, where her dad's just like, oh, get out, you know, you're no child of mine. And again, not saying that doesn't unfortunately happen to some people, but
unfortunately,
I think the wider reaction with most people is some flavor of, well, it's not my favorite thing for you, but I love you, so we'll work on it. And yeah, and I think what actually happens with Roberta's mom is a really, this is what Gyrick warned about in episode one. He had that line about, you're a fad. People look at you like, oh, look at my mutant friend. But when push comes to shove, they'll make their loyalties clear. And that's exactly what happens with Roberta's mom, is, you know, in that moment when push comes to shove, she decides that, like you said, the optics, she would rather just look like, oh, no, but we're taking our son away for his own good, and not that I'm publicly disowning him. Not disowning him, that's a bit extreme, but she certainly isn't willing to kind of put her weight behind him and say, no, you two need to leave.
And that's unfortunately, again, very very true to life, like you were saying. And I think if it was like the Rogue thing, and I think in the original show that was important to show that kind of relationship, because, you know, that probably wasn't shown. The original show was groundbreaking. You wouldn't have seen, you know, and he's got like an American flag on it. You know, he looks like one of the MAGA people, you know, absolutely. Like, he's the racist kind of redneck kind of, you know, hillbilly stereotype that we see. But it was kind of important to show that at the time. But now it's like, okay, we had that. We know what that's like. We've seen that. but let's maybe have this more of a nuanced thing, you know. And, you know, Roberto's mum's a, you know, person of color as well, so she can kind of identify with some of that, but still she's living a very privileged life as well. So again, lots of interesting kind of stuff for discussion that we'll no doubt not be able to discuss on this podcast because it's too much. It's far too much.
We don't want to make the people apathetic.
No, exactly.
You overload them.
I find it interesting as well, because in the original Operation Zero Tolerance, so OZT from last week is named in this, and it was kind of, Bastion was kind of in the comics, it was kind of a human face to the cold, unemotional, racist robots that we're used to seeing. And again, he talks about how they're too blunt and they need something more kind of discreet but deadly. And this kind of symbiotic relationship of the two is kind of almost like, again, and they're like sleeper agents, aren't they? They're like, you know, political sleeper agents. But it's kind of also a representation of like systemic racism or the hypocrisy that we've been talking about. Like, nobody really knows how racist they are until they're confronted with it. Like Roberto's mum, for example. Like, it's that, like, all of a sudden, like you said, you know, they're, you know, flirted with a mutant at the bar and they activate all of a sudden, and they don't know it themselves. They're unaware of what they are. Yeah, they sign up to it mostly. But yeah, and there's that argument for Bastion and him, you know, and his idea and what he wants and what he is trying to achieve, but also he's gone too far with it as well. Like, he's weaponized his own mum, for fuck's sake. You know? Like, he's turned his mum, and that's, again, some wonderful creepy body horror we see, like, you know.
Yeah, I wrote it down in my notes because when it happened, I did just go, oh, Jesus Christ.
And we're
not prepared for that.
And that's it. And I think it's the same with Magneto. When you push Magneto to the nth degree, he becomes another Hitler. Like, that's the irony of that character, is that he's, you know, a child of the Holocaust and Auschwitz, and he grows up to become, you know, he wants a master race himself. You know, if you push that character to its nth degree, that's what you get as a villain. But again, we're seeing a lot more nuance from Bastion. I think they're doing a really good job of kind of humanizing him, but also showing like the cold kind of fascistic take that he has. And I wanted to talk about Mr. Sinister as well, because we see Bastion's idea, his dream ends up as a utopia. And then they talk about Mengele, who was known for experimenting and doing genetic experiments and things like that. During those kind of days, in those kind of camps as well. And the fact that he's like, oh, I knew Mengele, but he was a Nazi pup. He could have been something. He could have been, if he wasn't kind of stuck on those Nazi ideals, he could have been something special. And then Sinister says, but that's my dream, pig pens of test subjects, which is kind of like, oof, you know. That's
a dystopian future. Like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
That kind of almost gives me like, you know, that image in the Matrix of the kind of like the battery labs of just like, yeah. So yeah, that kind of created a bit of an image in my head for what he's after. And that does seem at odds with what Bastion ultimately wants. Sure. So yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to see if they come to heads at some point, where at some point, you know, the roads are going to diverge in the woods and they might want different things. So then there might be a bit of friction there, but
yeah. And he's supposed to be, Bastion has a prize for him. Do you have any ideas what that prize might be? Because it doesn't seem like this team up doesn't seem to quite mesh for me. I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea, but obviously clearly they do want very different things, as we've shown. I imagine one of them will betray the other one at some point. That's kind of what happens with villains. When villains team up, they go, oh, well, I do this. I wonder if maybe Madeline's still alive and that's the prize. Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good theory, because I mean, obviously what happened, you know, his plan with Madeline was to kind of create a super mutant.
Yeah, because so their genetics are the best for creating offspring. In the comics, he was created by Apocalypse and he wanted to destroy Apocalypse. And he said the only way to do that was to create a child that had the power to do that. And these two mutants happen. And he kind of put them together as well. He kind of you know, operated his plan and kind of made them kind of get closer to each other in order to facilitate that. But then when the Phoenix died, then he needs to make Madeline as a clone to engage and do that. But yeah, so maybe we're going to see something like that. I don't know, but
maybe like you said as well, you know, maybe somehow, because there's not been any mention of Apocalypse. Well, actually, no, I lied. There was that one line from Logan in episode two. another good comedy moment. Anyway, yeah, so maybe somehow Bastien knows how Sinister could kill Apocalypse. He might allow that to happen in some ways. Maybe that's his prize, is finally getting to achieve that goal. But
I know in the show in his origin story, which Bo DiMaio did say you need to go back and look at that, he creates himself. So it's a little bit different from the comic book origin, and Chris Claremont's origin for that character is wildly different as well. You should go look that up, because that's interesting in itself. I think they explore it in X-Men Forever, which was written by Chris Claremont, what the original origin would have been for the character. But yeah, he isn't really linked to, he kind of just wants to genetically engineer super slaves, if I remember rightly from the episodes I've watched recently. That's his kind of goal, plan, you know, a mutant slave army. And again, Morph described him as taking in kind of genetic mutant material into himself, which we see in Descent, which is kind of very Darwinian episode, which I actually quite enjoy. It's one of the latter episodes, which kind of do vary in quality a little bit. I do think that was one of the better ones. And then he creates Jack the Ripper. And
yeah, I know.
Genius. I loved it. And you've got all the whole Victorian garb and everything. And again, like in the comics, like he experimented on Magneto. I think Magneto described him as the Pale Man, which we saw a little bit in First Class, where they kind of forced Sebastian Shaw into that role, which never kind of fit with me.
Yeah, it was an odd choice, like Sebastian Shaw in particular. I think we mentioned this in the last podcast. Like, I reckon that was probably a decision in that it was still that period in time in which comic books are doing, comic book adaptations are successful, but we're still kind of a bit shy of going too far as to, you know, make them as kind of silly and outlandish as comic books be. So, you know, maybe they thought Mr. Sinister, with his kind of bright white skin and kind of vampire cape garb, they were like, maybe
he's
kind of
fabulous.
He's fabulous. X-Men is for the gays.
It is. And I think his, you know, flamboyance and his costume would have fit better him leading the Hellfire Club than Sebastian Shaw being a Nazi scientist, you know. I just feel like that's an easier transition.
Well, if you showed me them pictures like side by side, Sebastian Shaw and Mr. Sinister, had said who of these is the leader of the Hellfire Club?
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you on that. But yeah, speaking of kind of all the characters, you know, and all the different kind of takes and all those different little moments. We got a lot of cameos in this episode. Who would you like to talk about first?
Well, yeah, our boy Spidey shows up. I think that's the one that everybody excited. I think we mentioned last time as well, the fact that that definitely feels like a, you know, this animated series has done really well. So I'm sure that we'll get an adaptation of the Spider-Man one. Yeah. As well, so that just felt like a nice little nod to it's probably coming. So yeah, that was great, and I think most of us probably all had that when Spidey showed up. And it's great as well, because I think you might have said last time as well, it just makes the world feel bigger. It's not just the X-Men, because I think the issue sometimes with all these Marvel properties is they sometimes feel like they operate in very separate spheres. So that's when it's great when you do get kind of, you know, Captain America comes in, or you know, you get these little cameos and stuff, because it just makes the wider world feel so much more rich.
Absolutely. And Dave talked about it on the previous podcast, it becoming more kind of, and Max as well, they're enjoying the kind of growing of the animated Marvel universe, which, you know, a lot of these shows were very kind of vaguely connected when they came out, you know, Fantastic Four, Hulk, Iron Man, you name it. They're all sort of slightly connected, you know, and they all kind of crossed over one way or another. So yeah, I'm glad that they did it. And again, they keep the design is like spot on from the Spider-Man show. The eyes are exactly the same. Christopher Daniel Barnes, who voiced Spider-Man, has gone on social media and he said, you know, he said, we're not involved. There's nothing ongoing. There's no discussion. I've not been asked to do anything. It's cool. I'd love it to happen. I would be there in a minute, but there is no discussion that has been made. And the original showrunner as well, he said the exact same thing. There's been no discussion. I'd love to do it. If the opportunity is there, I'll take it. And I imagine those discussions are going to be happening quite soon, I imagine.
Yeah, I reckon so. I think that's a watch this space situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think out of all the kind of Marvel characters, I do think Spider-Man and the X-Men have the most in common. Like they're both, I mean, it depends on the Spider-Man depiction, but there's a lot of them where like he's really like despised by the general public or by, you know, J. Jonah Jameson and all that. So there is kind of that relatability there that they're both kind of almost outlaw heroes to a degree.
Yeah, and especially because Spider-Man is, you know, often quite depicted as, you know, he's pretty low on, you know, he's working class, you know, yeah. He lives in a shitty apartment in New York and he kind of struggles to make ends meet in his day jobs and he struggles to kind of hold down a girlfriend for various reasons. So yeah, he's not this sort of super genius millionaire. So yeah, I think he's much more relatable and, like you said, is quite often dealing with that prejudice that's peddled by the media.
Exactly. So we also got a few surprising cameos. One wasn't that surprising. We have Daria. So Daria was the kind of right hand woman to Bastion, who is also a Prime Sentinel. She shows up. I can't remember too much about her, but I think she eventually betrays Bastion, helps free Jubilee, who he's been kind of using a machine to pull out all of her secrets about the X-Men, their weaknesses and things like that, if I remember rightly. So it was interesting to see her. Again, it was, very, very minor kind of Easter egg for the people that are watching or fans of the comic. But I like that she was there. And then we also get a Doctor Doom himself and Baron
Zemo.
Which
I missed somehow on my first watch through, which I'm gutted about. I must have looked away or something. But yeah, because I was like, oh my God, Zemo was there. And then everybody in the comments is like, Doctor Doom. Like, how did I miss that?
Yeah. And I think you said it on the last podcast, if you're being criticized for committing war crimes by Doctor Doom, no matter how good your argument is, Bastion, you're definitely the bad guy.
Like, bro, tone it down.
And it's interesting that they're kind of colluding as well. And Baron Zemo, Val, it takes the entire episode for Val Cooper to go,
are we the baddies?
Are we the bad guys? Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, if you have Doctor Doom, again, a war criminal dictator who's part of the plan, and Baron Zemo, whose father was a Nazi and has a group called the Masters of Evil, do you think maybe you're on the wrong side of history here, Val? Do you think? Maybe.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see what they do with Val as a character, because she's obviously not she's not died. And I mean, the fact that she kind of, you know, she frees Magneto, basically, like, she just does, to kind of like spoil the end of the episode. Sorry about that. But so she frees Magneto. And Bastion comes back, doesn't kill her, which I thought that would be a pretty unforgivable betrayal offense. But he's obviously kept her alive. So it does feel like they're building her up for something. There's a lot of talk about, you know, is she Mystique? Which I don't know. I don't buy it. I can see why people are thinking it, because, you know, Mystique's got to turn up at some point. It seems feasible as like the only kind of random human woman who's there just on the sidelines, it would be. Yeah. But I just don't know what Mystique would get out of this, aligning herself with these people.
And that's my issue sometimes with villains teaming up, like, you know, Bastion and Sinister. It doesn't always kind of gel for me. You know, like, you remember like Batman and Robin, where, like, you know, Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy are teaming up and you're thinking, that's not really, giant ice world's probably not good for plants.
No,
entirely plants, probably not.
I suppose sometimes it's, you know, enemy of my enemy is my friend. Sure. But yeah, there's definitely times where you're just like, but you guys are completely opposing sides, even in your own kind of evil. It's like that episode in the animated series where it starts off where Sinister like FaceTimes the X-Men. He's like, please, I need your help. And it was a bit like, whoa, this is wildly out of character for you.
That's a good episode. The Phalanx Covenant is, because you've got Magneto, Sinister, Forge. I think Quicksilver's there maybe, and Beast and Warlock as well. Not Adam Warlock, the other Warlock, the X-Men Warlock, New Mutants Warlock. That's a really good kind of two-parter, because I always like kind of like really oddball kind of groupings of teams. Like, you know, like you get like the B team, like the West Coast Avengers or something like that. It's not all the heavy hitters, because I feel like there's kind of like a genuine threat there, because you're not the main people. It's more likely you might fail, or just seeing like random groups of people together. It just kind of, I'm always quite interested by that, like weird kind of associations. But yeah, we also get Silver Samurai and Omega Red.
We do, yeah. So Omega Red will be an interesting one. Obviously, he and Logan are not friends. So, yeah, I wonder if they'll end up having a little fisticuffs moment at some point.
Definitely.
Well, I think it also just plays into the larger thing of, you know, talking about what obviously happens once Magneto is freed. You know, Justin is Speedos, you know, flies to the North Pole, presumably uses the polarity of the North Pole to basically cause a worldwide EMP, which is good because it destroys the Sentinels. But, you know, I've seen a lot of discussions about, oh, well, what would that mean for, you know, people who are on life support? You know, would that mean that commercial planes would drop out of the air? I don't think it would necessarily, but, or, you know, at this, anyway, again, off track. But, you know, the fact that we see that allows Omega Red to free himself and presumably cause havoc. So, yeah, it kind of makes sense as to why Logan describes that act as declaring war.
Yeah. And like people with pacemakers and various other things like that. So, and he doesn't care. He's in his villain era again, you know, if you want to use that phrase. He's like, they've proved me right. And, you know, that's what Val Cooper says, like, out of everything I've learned, you know, I've been through so much, and, you know, I saw everything. And my theory is Val Cooper is already a prime sentinel and doesn't know it. Or Bastion's about to make her one if she isn't already.
Well, that would explain why he keeps her alive. Be a nice kind of excuse for some villain monologuing in the next couple of episodes.
Yeah. I'm interested to know if those people are now dead, the Prime Sentinels, like, especially with, like, like Wolverine's chopping them up and Nightcrawler's chopping them to bits, you know, and that's what they did in the show. Like, Wolverine could only really use his claws on like robot villains, so they the Reavers would turn up or the Sentinels would turn up and you'd see him absolutely let loose. So I don't know. I love that they're like, they have this really long creepy tongue as well. It like pushes them. I love all the, again, all the body horror stuff I absolutely adore. So yes, and it's kind of Invasion of the Body Snatchers a little bit, you know, because anybody could be one of them. And again, that had a lot of like communist kind of, you know, allegories and things going on.
Yeah, Red Scare.
Yeah, the Red Scare and the McCarthyism of everything. So yeah, I think that's a good, and again, a good kind of thing and influence to pull from. But yeah, I wonder if they would live, or if they, you know, they go back to normal, or they're just dead. I don't know.
Yeah, also, if it's, because I suppose we don't know how many Prime Sentinels were activated, so, you know, maybe ones that are still dormant, you know, would it have taken them out? Would it have kind of kept that part of, would it keep that part of them dormant if they've been hit by this EMP? So yeah, I'm sure all these questions and more will be explored.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. And I wonder why he kept Bastion, kept Magneto alive as well. Like, is it to be so they can learn how to be resistant to his powers, or and then build that into Bastion or somebody else or any of the other Prime Sentinels, or is it that maybe Magneto is a Prime Sentinel himself?
Well, I did hear some rumors about, because obviously we've got Charles on his way back, and so there was a theory that was going round of, I think this was at the end of the previous episode, where it was revealed that Magneto was alive, and so some people were theorizing, is Bastion trying to get him and Charles together to create an onslaught situation? But I mean, possibly not now, because obviously Magneto has been freed, which I don't imagine was part of Bastion's plan. So yeah, I guess it'll be interesting seeing why he was kept alive, like what Bastion was thinking
Yeah, well, Beau de Mayo, again, the former writer, but the writer of this series, he said you've got to do some homework, and one of the pieces of homework was Fatal Attractions, which was an event where Magneto had become all powerful, and I think he was threatening to release an EMP to destroy the world, basically. And at the end of that storyline, Wolverine has his adamantium skeleton pulled from his body, but also Charles shuts down Magneto's mind, absorbing his psyche into his own, which then the merging of both Charles and Magneto's psyche creates Onslaught, which was, again, another big, huge 90s storyline, which I won't get into now. But yeah, that could potentially be something we see maybe next season, possibly. I don't know.
You can't bring out the Holocaust beam again, King Charles.
God. Oh, not again. He's like, yeah, he's just gonna be like, let me remind you of this really horrible event you experienced.
Like, had to bring that up.
Well, you know what? I like a morally dubious Charles Xavier. I think I like that he presents this kind of like, you know, Martin Luther King type, you know, equality and, you know, that's the dream, you know, that I have a dream stuff. But I like when he's a bit like morally dubious, like, you know, a deadly genesis.
Yeah, I think as a character, he is quite self-serving. And it's one of my favorite moments from the animated series, the episode where Sabretooth comes back and Logan calls him out on that. It's like, when you want revenge, you know, you have an entire arsenal of people who you can kind of, you know, coordinate to go and do that. But when I want revenge, you know, I need to pipe down and be the bigger man. And I do think that kind of, like you said, morally dubious element of Charles hasn't really been explored. I think the films, you know, certainly Patrick Stewart's portrayal is much more the kind of, oh, it's Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, which I was reading an article that was saying that, like, I think the original creators kind of take a little bit of umbrage with that comparison. Not umbrage, but I think they certainly said not quite what we were going for.
No, maybe not. But it's not as black and white as that, I don't think. But you can kind of see where the parallels have been made.
Yeah, of course.
And again, it was the civil rights movement inspired the book. So I can kind of, you know, even though if they're not specifically actively, you know, intended to be, there are lines there and connections. It'll be interesting to see if they go down the kind of Fatal Attractions route. He did say as well, we need to watch Sanctuary, which is all about Asteroid M as research for these episodes. So I imagine we're going to see Asteroid M in some form. But he also asked for people to watch The Final Decision, which is the end of season one, where Master Mold comes out of the kind of mining area. I think Bastion's hometown is the area that Master Mold was in, because it looks like it could be a mining town. There seems to be they go through all this like kind of rocky structures and stuff with the Porsche and all that. So I feel like maybe they're gonna reveal that maybe like Bastion's rebuilt Master Mold, or, you know, maybe Bastion's body is like a drone and his real body is this giant Nimrod Master Mold type thing. And then again, I don't think this will happen, but this is my silly thought, is that, you know, Magneto take Asteroid M and just throw it at Bastion's like giant form. I would again, this is me playing with my action figures again, but I would absolutely, like, I think that would be like an awesome moment. Whether they'll do that, I don't know. Whether it'll be the X-Men versus a Bastion controlled Magneto, maybe they're forced to kill potentially, or who knows. Maybe Bastion will just get eliminated in the next episode and it will be purely focused on Magneto and his war. But who knows? I'm really excited. I've got literal goosebumps from this episode. So I am absolutely on board for wherever they take it. I've no notes, no problems with this episode whatsoever. And again, I like that we had the downtime. And again, like, I know you're not a fan of the Mortendo episode, and most people aren't. And even the Shi'ar episode, I know Dave wasn't a fan of the Shi'ar stuff, but I think they are necessary with what we're talking about, because I think it would get very dour and depressing and
very
100%. Heavy. You need those kind of breaths of fresh air, the palate cleanse every now and again. And I think it only makes these last few episodes stronger for having, you know, the life, death, Shi'ar episode. And again, I think you said it does kind of somewhat gives a disservice to the life, death storyline to have it split, I believe.
Yeah, I think that was the only storyline that it felt like kind of bookending it with two half episodes. It just felt a wee bit of a damp squib for me. Like, I would have liked to have seen, you know, maybe see Storm kind of wrestle with not having her powers a wee bit longer, or at least kind of see her relationship with Forge explored a bit more, because, I mean, it's kind of understandable because she's Storm, but when Forge was like, I love you, it was a bit like, where did that come from? So it would have just been nice to see that. But I think you're really onto something if the biggest criticism you can think of is, I wish there was more of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sure they're gaining up Storm to come back. I mean, somebody said something about, you know, they maybe couldn't have Storm come back at this point because we couldn't have Storm and Magneto at the same time go full Omega level.
Omega level, yeah, absolutely. And I think when she makes her return, I think there have been some complaints like, where's Storm? Let's get Storm. What's Storm been up to? We don't know. You know, maybe Forge is still ill. Maybe she's fighting Prime Sentinels as she's trying to get to the X-Men. And then we end the episode with Charles returning and again says the immortal lines, which started the comic book itself, to me, my X-Men. And I think he sees Beast, Storm, Jean, and Cyclops. Like, those are kind of the oldest members of the team. So he goes to them first. Not the original lineup or anything, but we couldn't really, even though there's some continuity episode issues with the original lineup, which I've talked about before, but yeah, I love that. And I know there's some criticism. I've got a couple of comments from Max and Dave. So there are some criticisms about Charles's return, but I'll get into them shortly. Last couple of things I want to mention. There was a cameo right at the start of a very familiar character, William Stryker.
Ah, yes. We didn't get onto Stryker. Mm. Yeah, we did last time. But yes, that was a nice little cameo. Again, I only really know Stryker from X2, but I mean, talk about leaving an impact. I thought he was a fantastic villain. You know, Brian Cox did a great job there. So yeah, it'll be interesting if, like you said, if we get more episodic storylines in season 2 and 3, is he going to play a bigger role? Interesting.
Yeah, you were correct though last time you said, because I rewatched it and I said, oh, it's Reverend William Stryker. Like, in the comics, he's a kind of evangelical, preacher. And again, it kind of follows the storyline from the film, you know, captures Magneto, captures Xavier, and tries to use Cerebro to kill all the mutants. But they didn't, you didn't see Reverend and you didn't see like General or Colonel or anything. And I'm thinking, if he was a shadowy Weapon X style guy, I don't think he'd probably want to be in the news or on the kind of front line of the media campaign. But then he was quite close to the president, so in the film, so who knows? I think they probably not decided if they're going to go down that kind of route or storyline or what he's going to be. I'd be more interested in the kind of political, religious kind of thing. Would be, I think, more interesting than just going.
Yeah, well, he and Nightcrawler have a bit more of a history in the comics, don't they? So I suppose, obviously, with Kurt being kind of, you know, openly Catholic, that would be an interesting route to go down, because it would mean that those two could kind of parallel one another and, you know, like come to
And that's one of the wonderful things about Nightcrawler, is he's, you know, again, he has all these facets. He's the ladies' man, he's the swashbuckler, he is the, you know, the Catholic priest, you know, he is, you know, demonic in appearance, you know, and that's why he was, you know, he's being chased in Germany with pitchforks and torches, which, again, they talk about the people at the front.
Yeah, Cable has that line of like, oh, they've got the torches and pitchforks.
They're ready. Yeah,
90s
so,
Germany.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's so wonderful. And there's a famous panel of Reverend Stryker pointing at him going, you call that human? And there was a famous evangelical, horrible man. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was the inspiration. And there was like a little newsreel that they made. And he was like, oh, these subhumans are attacking this reverend. How dare they? And it's like, this character is clearly based on you and you're taking issue with it. And the fact that you're calling these characters subhuman, you're just hammering home the point of how fucking awful you are, taking advantage of people and asking to be healed and all that bollocks. But yeah, exactly. And I think that's something they could explore in the show quite well and quite, again, nuanced as well. Because I think there's a lot of self-righteousness when it comes to people being religious. I've got nothing against people being religious. I don't follow any sort of faith, but I appreciate everyone has faith. I think faith is fine, but yeah. I think when it, you know, personal.
I think it's when people try and exploit it for more nefarious reasons or
exactly.
for financial gain, then
yeah,
I have an
political
issue with it.
Capital gain. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, I think when it, when faith is a beautiful thing to have faith, but I think it's when it becomes a religion and it becomes a set of texts, that's when.
Yeah. And suddenly there's rules and it's,
yeah,
you know,
dogma and
suddenly
all
it's
that
a stick to beat other people down with. And
exactly. Like, exactly, you know, and all this, you know, don't cast the first stone, but then someone will find. I remember there was some sort of argument. I think they were arguing for the abolishment of the slave trade, I remember, and they used the same passage from the Bible to argue both sides of that. and that just said, that speaks volumes to me about religious texts and how they can be interpreted or misinterpreted in so many ways. Last thing I wanted to mention was there was a couple of kind of little tiny, tiny Easter eggs. So we got an image of a Stark Expo flyer in Bastion's room. So he's clearly got an interest in technology. And again, And arguably the Sentinel technology is quite similar to the Iron Man technology. You know, you've got the repulsor blasts, you know, boot jets. They've got a kind of a central chest thing. But also we get a little toy of the Machine Man. So I did a podcast a few years ago of top 5 Sentinel comics. Operation Zero Tolerance ended up in that. But I also included a book called Cable Hellfire Hunt, because it featured two annuals, which kind of closed off the Bastion storyline. We got his origin story and what he truly was. But at the end of Operation Zero Tolerance, it's kind of a bit anticlimactic because, spoilers, Bastion just gets arrested by S.H.I.E.L.D. and that's kind of it. So that's why I included that, because Machine Man, I think he's trying to make Machine Man into like the Uber Sentinel, or the, you know, using his technology, because I believe he's from the future originally, if I remember rightly, or not. It's confusing. he first appeared in a 2001 Space Odyssey comic, but then was folded into the main Marvel universe. It's a whole thing.
Go read
up on it. But I like that kind of little nod to, again, very specific Easter egg. But yeah, that's why I included that, because it felt, as much as I enjoyed Operation Zero Tolerance, what it was discussing, and there's a wonderful moment where J. Jonah Jameson kind of confronts Bastion about killing one of his reporters. And that's where I'm like, you know, J. Jonah Jameson's such a great character, because you're like, you're absolutely fully behind him with this, because he's like, if you've killed my reporter, because Bastion's asking him to like destroy some of the evidence and don't run a story that he's found. And J. Jonah Jameson's like, no, I might not like mutants, I might not like superheroes, but I really don't like you oppressing the press and the free speech.
You do not mess with ethics in journalism.
Exactly. And again, he's hypocritical as well. It
depends. Oh, yeah.
It's
like that line from the first Spider-Man film where people are like, JJJ shows that he's a really good guy, because when the Goblin turns up, he's like, I don't know who his stuff is, he just comes in the mail. And it's like, I don't think he's necessarily doing it to protect Peter, it's just he's just a bit of a job worse.
Yeah. I don't think he's entirely a bad guy, but again, that's the nuance of that character. You can have him as, you know, the raging, you know, he's inside a Spider Slayer robot, but also you can have him as this kind of genuine believer in, like there's a bit in the comics where he admits to creating the Scorpion. He's like, I was fully behind that. I stepped down as the editor. And Spider-Man goes, yeah, what about all those Spider Slayer robots you made, though? You didn't mention that. and he's like, you know, there's a lot of levels to J. Jonah Jameson. That's why I think he's one of the best kind of characters. And I think that for a J. Jonah Jameson moment is pretty good. Like he will stand up when he believes that integrity is being exploited. But yeah, I do recommend those comics and stuff. So, is there anything else you want to say about Operation Zero Tolerance? Tolerance is Extinction, part one.
Is there anything else I want to say? Just looking through my notes. I think we've covered everything, really. Like you said, a real no notes of an episode. I think it's a perfect start to a three-parter. I think it already had such kind of chilling, hopeful, harrowing moments. So I can't wait to see where they go with it, but I am also really going to miss it once it's done.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that.
I'm excited, but I'm also anxious as well. especially after the Genosha episode, I'm like, are we going to lose some characters? I wonder if maybe we've just got Charles back just to lose him, maybe as well, potentially. I don't know. We'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
It will, just quickly as well, I think it will be interesting seeing what the response to Charles coming back is like. I don't think it will be a particularly warm welcome from everybody. I can imagine there might be some X-Men who might be pretty pissed, especially because
I hope
I'm not too late.
Yeah.
how much worse did you think things might get?
Yeah. And again, he's shown as like, be it like somehow they pull the transmission from the Shi'ar galaxy. I guess it's a future Sentinel tech thing that he can do. But
I think it was something to do with Bastion hacked a satellite that they used to communicate with the Shi'ar.
Right.
I think we were talking about that in, or I think David Maxwell of like, you know, have they got that really good tech? So yeah. Which, yeah, is a fair question.
Fair point. It's a fair point.
Yeah, so I think that was what Bastion said in the episode. He hacked a satellite that was used for comms.
And he's out there living his best life. He's not dead. He's walking, you know, and they'll probably be like, look what's happened to this. You forgot about it. And that's his whole episode. His whole dilemma is, should I forget about my children or do I go back, or, you know.
I think Scott especially, you know, because he's got his own kind of abandonment issues that are front and center. I think he's gonna be really pissed off.
There's a great line. He's like, I wish Charles was here to teach me how to be a father. And Jean's like, some lessons are taught and some lessons are learned, which I thought was again, there's kind of that dramatic tension between the whole family unit going on. Wonderful bit of writing. That's great. I'm so, thank you very much for joining me again. because of various technical issues. I'm usually so
damn
good
you,
with this.
Bastion!
Damn you, Bastion! Maybe I'm a prime sentinel. Maybe I'm self-sabotaging myself. Maybe that's what it is. Who knows? But we do have a couple of comments from Dave and Max, so I'm just going to read those out, hopefully better than I did last time. So here we go. So this is from Dave. In case you were after any feedback for this evening, Spider-Dan, absolutely love the episode yet again. My man Magneto with his seething rage beneath the surface was done really well. The only slight negative for me was Xavier turning up. We knew he was going to, but I like seeing the X-Men wrestle with the ideologies and wonder if Magneto's way was the right way. Also, I'd previously given Roberto's mom a bit of a pass, but no, she's a genuine dick.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah. I can understand why they have Xavier, because I think your general audience, it kind of expects him to be there. He's kind of a touchstone and he's got the group together, and you know, I can understand why they feel they would need him to come back and to see how he's getting on and what we're gonna see later on. I honestly kind of sometimes do enjoy when the X-Men are out on their own. You know, they once were living in Australia in the outback for some reason. I won't get into it, but that's, you know, X-Men comics have been through many ups and downs, many changes and evolutions and stuff. But I get what he means. I can understand it. But I think the general audience would still need that kind of linchpin of the franchise to be there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think for Cable to be describing this utopia, which actually isn't very good for the mutants, as, you know, he uses the phrase Charles's dream, I think for that to be actually framed as something that isn't good, I think Charles himself needs to be there to see and hear that and, you know, maybe argue his case. And, you know, I do wonder if that's going to cause a bit of a schism in the X-Men, because, you know, people are kind of realizing that maybe Charles's idealistic dream isn't that practical or isn't achievable. So yeah, I think for those to kind of be the core kind of issues at play, I think Charles does need to be there. And yeah, like, it will be interesting to see what he does in the team, especially in the kind of finale episodes, because as somebody pointed out as well, that there's a reason why Charles is always decommissioned at the end of every single X-Men film, because he's too powerful. But I think we've, apart from the Skulls in Session segment, we haven't really seen him kind of get to flex his powers properly in a while, so I think it'll be nice to kind of see him come back and, you know, be a part of the team.
Yeah, I'm absolutely on board for him coming back, but I do get Dave's criticism of it. So Max says, I thought, just when I thought I couldn't scale. It couldn't scale to any bigger heights, even bigger heights. It does. Pulling back the curtain on the past of the uber-villain Bastion is the key for one twisted family situation. Expertly building upon the seeds planted in the original series, the sheer thrill of seeing Marvel legends such as Spider-Man and Doctor Doom on screen makes this universe seem all the larger, in giving the final moments of the episode to the two senior figures, Xavier and Magneto, to supply the mic drop moments is enough to make any fanboy or girl fist pump with a ferocity that cannot be measured. Two episodes to go, and it's going to be huge. Strap yourselves in to me, my X-Men. And also, seeing the Summers family kick some ass was joyous.
It was joyous. And yeah, I kind of feel like that is something I need to say, like, you know, as someone that only really watched the series and the films, like, I will never cease my penance walk for thinking that Scott Summers was uncool. So yeah, I really appreciate the fact that this series has put Scott front and center and kind of shown all the great sides of him. Because yeah, their kind of family moment where they all, you know, like driving through that canyon with the Sentinels chasing them was brilliant. Like just seeing them all come together and work together.
Yeah, just all brilliant. I love that Jean drives the car and they're shooting, you know, Cable's holding them off and he's making a path through the mountain. Just absolutely amazing. And then that wonderful shot where they all jump out of the Porsche. I love that Cable's like, he's like a proper boy. He's like, you've got a Porsche? I love
nice
that.
Nice little X2 reference as well. Because I'm sure it's a Porsche that Scott drives in X2.
Yeah.
Not a great advert though, considering that Wolverine can hotwire it with them.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. But there you have it. There you have it. But yeah, thank you, Sarah. Thank you for joining me again. I think this is better than the last one, I think. Not that the last one was bad, but I think we've evolved as a podcast.
Yes, we like Bastion have evolved.
We've upgraded it.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, no, once again, been a pleasure. I will always happily sit and talk Marvel X-Men to the cows come home.
I was going to say it's going to be a second season, so I think me and Max will be back on this whenever that comes out. I know I've heard some rumors about them kind of fast-tracking it, trying to get it out sooner. I know they've already recorded the dialogue, I believe, for the second season, so it's just a case of getting it animated. But I hope they don't rush it either.
I don't want them to rush it. Like I think that's, like I said, I think this has been, it feels like this has been crafted with so much love, and that's what makes it great. So I just think, like, take their time. The audience is there. I will happily wait until it's, you know, the level they think it is to it's ready. So, yeah, I hope they don't.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But absolute pleasure again.
They're even talking about a new X-Men live action film. It's apparently in motion. There's rumors that it's going to be mostly focusing on the female characters, and we're going to see characters we've never seen on screen before, I think I read somewhere. And that I'm all up for that.
Scottish Wolfbane.
Was it Maisie Williams in?
It was.
You can. Yeah, it was an accent. I'll say that it was an accent. Not that I didn't particularly mind that version. That it was kind of a mutant horror film, but I can understand why people didn't gel with it. And again, it was delayed 5 times, 7 times, however much. But yes, the Fox X-Men are kind of coming to an end. The Fox universe is coming to an end very shortly. And that's where you're going to get all your Wolverine content from. So don't worry. This year you will be getting some serious Wolverine content. But yes, we'll leave it there. And we will see you next time on Examining X-Men 97. Do 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 do